Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Melanie Marquis is the author of 8 Llewellyn titles, including IPPY award winner Carl Llewellyn Weschke, Beltane, A Witch's World of Magic, and Tarot Reflections award winner Modern Spellcaster's Tarot. She's a local coordinator for the Pagan Pride Project and the producer of the Mystical Minds Convention. Her latest book is Cookbook of Shadows, Simple Recipes for Powerful Magic, released in February 2024. Melanie Marquis, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you on and talk writing and cooking and all that good stuff with you.
Yeah, definitely.
But our traditional first question for everybody, kind of before we jump into all that, is, you know, in this... I guess, especially when we're talking about cooking, even maybe in, you know, this age of social media and quick videos and stuff like that, why write? Why still write books?
Well, I enjoy reading books. So I imagine I'm not the only one that enjoys just having the feel of a book in my hands. Like, I don't even like the tablets. I know a lot of people like those, but I just think, like, I don't know, there's just no substitute to me for like holding a book, and it's just its own medium for getting information. It's very relaxing and it's very lasting. You know, we have all these digital media forms, but you know, they're not guaranteed to last, to be around, to be like archived. You know, it's important to have like actual hard copies of stuff. So that's why I like to write books.
Yeah, I like that idea. I don't think anyone's pointed out about like the ephemeral nature of like digital stuff and how it is nice to have something more lasting. I don't think anyone's ever brought that up before. So unique answer.
Yeah, I kind of got some insight in writing the biography I wrote about Carl Llewellyn Weschke. He had kept so much research notes from decades of living, you know, and working for the civil rights movement in Minnesota and from all his magical studies and newspaper clippings. And he had kept it all. And the whole experience taught me that if you don't keep stuff like that, some things can be lost in history, and history can literally be lost if we don't like archive it and save hard copies of it. Because I, you know, in my research, I found all this information about like Carl's civil rights work that would otherwise have been lost to the ages, and no one would know the story of, you know, trying to gain like housing rights in Minnesota that took place. It was all thanks to him saving that information that allowed me to like retell that story. So I don't know. It's important, I think, to chronicle our own histories and write stuff, you know, that is important to all of us.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no guarantee with digital formats. Like I think about, you know, like I don't have anything that reads CDs in my house even right now, let alone like a floppy disk or something, like, you know, so those digital formats get lost in time too. And
right. I still can't bring myself to get rid of my CD collection, though, because I've come from the era of like liner notes was such a special thing. Like you get a new album and then you're so stoked if it has like the song lyrics in it, and you can like sit there and listen to the album while you read all the lyrics. Yeah. We don't have that now, I guess, probably in digital format.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, people don't listen to music the same way. Like, you know, I think about like, if you want to listen to an album and you have a digital music collection, you kind of have to think about it specifically and do that and go listen to it, because it's so easy to just listen to a mix or a radio station or something on your music player. And, you know, that experience of listening to an album and why those songs are in that order and all that is so different now.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you've written about a lot of different things for Llewellyn. You mentioned you'd written Carl Llewellyn Weschke's biography. You've written about the Beltane holiday in that Sabbat series they did. You've written about like the diaspora of magic all over the world. and tarot stuff and now cookbook too. So obviously a witch of many interests. Is so what brought you to a cookbook with all of that kind of stuff in the background?
Well, I've always loved cooking and I've always been a magical cook, I guess. So I wanted to do something to give, just to give people a different kind of foundation in cooking magic where people could build their own recipes and kind of create mm-hmm. their own recipes. So I felt like that was maybe kind of missing a little bit, was just kind of like the foundational knowledge of, like I wanted people to be able to understand like the magical correspondences of different food ingredients and different ways that you can use cooking techniques themselves, or just by choice of ingredients, choice of recipe, choice of utensils, even can make a huge difference in making a meal magical. So I wanted to make a book that was kind of more simple and to try to like kind of lay that foundation, but also something that where experienced cooks would still find it to be like a really, really handy reference. So it's kind of customizable to everyone's experience level. And also wanted to do it like this book, a shadow style, where there's space built into the book where it's meant to be used like a book of shadows, where the reader can add their own notes and add your own correspondences and your own recipe notes about how to make it even tastier like you like it. So I just wanted to make something a little bit different in the realm of cooking magic.
Mm-hmm. I do like that aspect of it, the kind of the pages that are, you know, let you add your stuff. Cause I think, I mean, I know there are a lot of people who are like, please don't mark in your books or dog ear or any of that kind of stuff. But I feel like cookbooks especially kind of invite that because you do change things when you make it. Or, and so I really enjoyed that aspect of the book. You've written for the almanacs and stuff. So you had published recipes with Llewellyn before, or?
Yes. For the Sabbath series books, I've written in different almanacs and stuff. So I've had different recipes for them before. But yeah, I wanted it to kind of have the feel of almost like a recipe box where you have like, you know, a box with different cards of different, you know, different recipes and ingredients and stuff. So I wanted it to be kind of like, feel personal like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you find like doing a whole cookbook, like writing wise, was that more of a challenge than some of the other stuff you did? Or did you feel like this was kind of like in your wheelhouse and more of a fun writing experience?
Well, it was kind of different because it wasn't really like writing per se. It was more like figuring out what's actually in my recipes, because like I've lived in the South for a lot of my life. I lived in the South. So I'm a Southern cook a lot, you know, in my heart is a cook, a Southerner, which means I don't measure anything. But of course that doesn't work for a cookbook. You can't be like, oh, let's pour some in your hand, a small handful. So that was the most challenging for me, is I had to go back and test and retest all these recipes I've been making for years, but just to figure out like, how much do I actually put in here? Because I can do it just, you know, sprinkling on the spice till it feels just right. And it would be, you know, taste the same every time, but having to actually like do that in my hand and then pour it into like a little measuring spoon to figure out like, okay, this is how much this is. That was probably the biggest challenge, to actually figure out what is in my various recipes I've been making for years.
Yeah. Recipe testing is, like, for folks who don't know, like recipe testing is like a whole different beast. You're right. I mean, people expect recipes to be precise, even like what I always say is hot kitchen recipes as opposed to like baking recipes. I mean, baking recipes are chemistry. That's like a whole different thing. But you know, like hot kitchen stuff is more, you do kind of measure things with your heart, right? But it doesn't work that way in a cookbook. So,
right. Yeah, you can't be like, till it feels right. That said, though, I did try to make most of my recipes are very like flexible and forgiving, where you kind of can just, you know, put however much feels good.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things I like about it, for folks who haven't seen the book, it's kind of broken down into like an introduction where you talk about the magic of the kitchen and all of that, and then a recipe section, and then the correspondences kind of at the end, like a section on ingredients and what they mean at the end, I guess. And I like that approach, which again kind of goes back to that Book of Shadows thing. It's like, we're going to talk about this part and then add that in. So research wise, how did that last part go? Because that seems like where it would be the part where you really have to kind of buckle down and look at like your own experience plus what's already out there So how did that research go for that?
Yeah, definitely. I checked, you know, old herbals, you know, like the oldest ones that are out there. And then I used like Scott Cunningham is one of my favorite herbalists. So I used his correspondences and my own and kind of cross-referenced those with the older guides. But, you know, there's so much disagreement about many of these plants and things. You know, you kind of, a lot is going to be like your own personal intuition and stuff. But it's important to see like that where things come from and the different traditions and different correspondences for these plants and herbs, and to know like the reasoning behind it. So I think like if you know the reasoning for something symbolizing something, then it's going to be like more valid. Or if you can come up with your own symbolism and reason it out and it makes sense, then that's gonna work for you, because nothing is just one thing, you know.
I mean, I found that in my own research that, you know, you go and you look at like Agrippa will say this plant belongs to this planet, and then three other grimoire writers will say, no, it's the sun, not Mercury.
Yeah, whatever. I like to say like every radish is a platypus because like, if you look at the radish plant, like the radish, like it grows underground, like the part of the radish that you eat grows underground. So that would make it be like, you know, earth. But it's also red and it has like a fiery taste. So that's kind of like fire. But then it's like cool and white and watery inside, which is like water. And then like the leaves are like kind of like lacy and airy. So it has like all these elements could be, you know, justified as being enough for the radish plant, and kind of everything is kind of like that. So yeah. You kind of have to go with, you know, what seems the most prominent and, you know, kind of highlight those aspects.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the nice things about the book is you leave folks room to go, yeah, that this is what I think this is. And I think that to me, like cooking, like, you know, kitchen witchery or, you know, cooking magic is kind of like all magic. Like it's this recipe or this ritual written out or the spell written out is kind of a roadmap, but not a forced march through it.
Yeah, definitely.
So obviously research for this book, but I'm really curious, like how you came to write the biography for Carl Llewellyn Weschke and like the research for that. Like what, I mean, I know it's not your current book, but I really wanted to ask you about it.
That was honestly, it was just like an experience of a lifetime that I got to do that. Carl and I actually never met in person, but we somehow developed a friendship over the years, just talking through email. Like years ago, before I had gotten a book published, I tried to interview different people in the community. And I contacted Llewellyn trying to get a quote from him. And they're like, oh no, he doesn't do that. Then like I kept researching and I tracked down, I found somewhere where Carl himself had given his own email address and something to say, hey, contact me. So I'm like, well, I'm going to contact him. And sure enough, he answered me back very thoughtfully and answered my question for the article I was writing for Witchbox at the time, I think it was. And just since somehow it developed, and we just, you know, we talk about all kinds of personal things. He was kind of like my, kind of like a grandpa, a mentor, and just friend. We shared lots of stuff.
Oh, nice.
Definitely. But so he was just like my friend, you know. Another a mutual friend of ours had actually like asked Carl while he was still alive, you know, asked him if he could write his biography, and Carl himself was like, well, I don't think anybody would buy it. He's like, I don't even know if I would invest in a biography about myself. And he's like, besides, I'm not dead yet. So I would wait till, you know, I've got to be, you know, wait till I'm dead. Then, you know, you can write a biography about me if you want or whatever. So when he passed away, that original friend had wanted to do the book asked me if I would be interested in helping with that. So I said yes, but then as the project progressed, they ended up not being a good fit for the project. So I ended up just taking the rest of it on myself. So, but it was so amazing. Like I could not, like Carl Llewellyn Weschke, he was the owner of Llewellyn Worldwide, for those who don't know. But like, so I got to travel to Llewellyn to go through his personal files, which was basically like box after box of extremely well-organized stuff from his like copious amounts of civil rights work. He worked with the NAACP and ACLU in Minnesota. He was a leader in these organizations. during the civil rights era. So that was a whole other story I wasn't even expecting to find. He also had notes about a haunted house he had lived in and all these different magical clubs and organizations that he had, you know, made and set up, and covens with, you know, Lady Sheba, all these, like, you know, different luminaries of the day. And he had, like, personal correspondences with, you know, him and, you know, Israel Regardi, and, you know, just all these, like, you know, Raymond Buckland. And I got to look through all this stuff. So it was amazing. Like, I literally had, like, magical history in my hands for, like, several days. I just spent from morning till they closed at night just going after page, Xeroxing as much as I could, because there was so much of it, I couldn't even take notes. It was just, I took all my time to just be able to just copy this stuff that was, like, that I needed to get. But he did such an amazing job with that company, like, in writing his story, like, what he did, like, for Llewellyn, like, it was just basically a small mail order company. It just sold, like, some astrological pamphlets. But this man grew this company into what it is today, which is this worldwide huge book publisher, one of the major, probably the most major well-known magic book publisher that we have, that's the most reputable and been around for over 100 years, you know, and built up this, like, huge reputation where they do all kinds of subject matters. And he really opened the doors for that. But what I found very interesting in, like, going through and seeing all of his notes and stuff and all the stuff he had saved is Carl personally, like, he didn't, like, when he started out, he was kind of like a one-man show. He did this all himself, but this man would contact, like, newspaper reporters all over the country, and he cultivated these relationships. And he basically kind of helped make it be a thing by talking about it as if it was a thing, and being the rise of witchcraft. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he started contacting reporters. Oh, hey, have you heard people are excited about this new spirituality, you know, that's come to America? And, you know, people are getting these books now. And, you know, he really, like, talked it up, and he created these spaces for people to explore these ideas like they want. And, you know, he never wanted credit for any of it. He was kind of like the Wizard of Oz, like the wizard behind the curtain type, like, you know, nobody knows who he is. He never got famous himself. He was an old man before he himself started writing books himself, you know. But here he is, like, doing all this stuff and orchestrating this stuff. And, you know, he's found all these authors, and he is a space maker and a visionary, and that Carl's gift was being able to see people's potential more than they could see it themselves. And that's what Llewellyn continues to do for people through the books that we publish, is it helps people be more than they are, as Carl would say. And it gives us, you know, gives everybody these doorways to open and grow. So it was truly an honor. Sorry, I went on and on about that, but it was
an amazing experience
to write that book and to be able to look through all this magical history. It was just truly once in a lifetime special experience. His spirit was also there, like, during it too. It was a haunted room.
Do you think, like, doing that research and writing that book, like, did it have an impact, like, on your own practice or, like, on other aspects of your writing, having that experience?
It did. And yeah, it made me want to keep better organization, for one thing, which I still haven't done. But it really, it clued me into more to taking astrology more seriously and going through all of it. Because, you know, I had dabbled in it, but I hadn't really looked at astrology literally before, not very literally. I looked at it in an abstract way, but looking through all Carl's notes and seeing how he built up the company and how he was very particular about when he made various business moves and decisions. Like, it's not abstract at all. It's very literal. It's like a clock in the sky. So that kind of, I learned that from looking through his stuff. And picked up some various magical visualizations and things, some little rituals.
Oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought about like the practical aspect of astrology in relation to, like, his business and the publishing. And that's fascinating to learn.
Yeah. One thing I would like to share that I did learn, that I think everybody can do different versions of this, but this is something I learned from writing the book, from just reading through his own notes. And he'd mentioned it to me in an email before, but I didn't realize, like, how exacting he was about it. But so every day he would do this visualization where he imagined, like, himself, and he connected with the spirit of an eagle. So he'd like think about an eagle and think about that eagle spirit, and this being the spirit of Llewellyn and the company. And he would like stretch that out and think about this feeling of love and growth encompassing every author, every employee, every distributor, every bookstore, all their sales force, all their, you know, people that buy these books and sell them to, you know, the market, like all the readers, like he would like visualize this like expanding love, enveloping all these, you know, bigger, to bring everybody into that. And I think that really honestly like propelled the company forward. And I think we can all do versions of that in our own life where we just think about what do we care about and what do you bring to the world? And then just push that feeling out and think about that spreading over and around all those that you love.
Yeah, I love that. Did you always want to write, or did you come to writing later? I mean, were you writing when you were a kid, or?
Yeah, I was always a writer. Then I got, I did art for a while. Like, I still do art. I'm like a folk artist. But I remember distinctly when I started showing my paintings and being like, well, I'm an artist. Writing is so boring. I can't believe I ever thought I was going to be a writer. I am an artist for sure. But then I ended up, unfortunately, dropping out of college. I was a college dropout. You know? So, yeah, like a friend of mine passed away and I did not take it very well and ended up messing up my online college studies and dropping out. So I thought, let me try a career that I can do without a college degree. And I thought, well, I've always liked writing. And I've always been into magic. So let me try. I figured I'd try writing magic books. So that way I could kind of learn the ropes of writing professionally. And if I didn't do good, then well, people in the mainstream, I would still have that to go to after trying it out in the smaller niche community. But only my first article I pitched, Llewellyn published, and then I got my books published later. So it's a win-win, and I haven't looked back since.
Have you mostly written books, I guess, in that magical niche, or are you still interested in stepping outside that?
Yeah, so far I've written some kids books, and I do want to, I'm working on a fiction book actually that I think it's going to be good when it's done, because I keep getting too disturbed to continue. I have to set it aside for a while, but I feel like that's a good sign. And it'll be good when it comes out finally.
Yeah. I mean, they always say no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. So if you're
right,
if you're scheming yourself out, the readers are going to be there too.
Yeah. It was shocking though, in writing the fiction, I'm realizing how like writing fiction is like more true to who you are as a writer than writing nonfiction is like so non-personal. You know, I can write nonfiction all day, but when I'm writing fiction, I'm like, oh, people are going to be able to judge my heart and soul from this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not just my writing abilities. This is different.
Yeah. I write fiction, and I've had that experience of, oh, is this about you? And I'm like, no. I mean, yes, right. The characters are from me and the story is from me, but this is not about my life.
It'd be like, the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
And guilty. Yes.
Yes.
So this book, well, this is coming out in May. So folks will hear this in May, but this cookbook came out in February. So I assume you have more coming up. So what are you working on now, or what are you interested in right now?
Well, I have some different book proposals in the works. I'm not sure if they're going to be accepted yet, so I can't really talk about those. But I am working on an Oracle deck. I'm trying to grow a culinary line. I'm trying to create some magical houseware products and kind of make that line develop. I've made products here and there, and they've never been able to build up an inventory. People grab them up, but I'm trying to create like a selection of like, you know, pot holders, spoons, whisks, everything you need for the kitchen, but make it magical themed and also have like a magical spice line. So hopefully by the time that this airs, I will have that going at my website. So
awesome.
Let's hope. Please check it out and see my progress.
What has that process been like to develop that? Because I mean, that's like design, manufacture. I mean, there's a whole lot of steps to that. So what has that process been like?
Yeah, well, I guess that's what my holdup is. I'm not good at like, I haven't been able to like upscale, like upsize things, or, you know, kind of, I make like one-off things, you know, one of a kind. I've made a few aprons. I've made some kitchen utensils. I've made some pot holders and you know, that people have bought, but I haven't ever been able to like make, oh, here's a whole supply of stuff. So basically I just need to devote like a week or a weekend and just, you know, craft and make the stuff. But you know, I just love creating all kinds of different ways. So I like kind of different mediums.
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea too of like, you know, especially doing magic around cooking or kitchen witchery or however people want to talk about it. You know, I think a lot, like you said, a lot of books focus on kind of recipes or whatever, but to think about like actual, the tools that you use, your pots and pans, your wooden spoon, you know, all of those things are part of that experience, especially if you come to magic as an animist, those things all bring their own, you know, their own spirit to your work. So I think that's really interesting to expand that out into like kitchen tools and things like that.
Yeah. And like the way I organized it, I wanted to organize it like, so there's like a section of like magical goals where you can look up like, you know, happiness, courage, prosperity, and find ingredients for that, find recipes for those things. And there's also a section of like elements. So you can pick out recipes and ingredients for that align with fire, water, air, earth, you know, whatever you want like that. And the same thing with planetary alignments. And there's just the general ingredient correspondences where it has like even more ingredients just listed with their magical properties and correspondences. Cause I wanted people to like have this foundation that they could have these different ways to look at things where they could design their own types of kitchen magic and find the correspondences that they need and kind of have that foundation where they're not just following, oh, here's a recipe that's supposed to be magical, but they understand like how to create a magical meal. And I wanted to give people different ways to be able to create a magical meal. So in my book, you can have, you know, thousands of new ways to make your meals magical, you know, based on the information in there. So yeah. I wanted to give people those tools to do that.
So as a cook, are you a cookbook collector?
I do like some cookbooks. I tend to like really old cookbooks. Like I like the old fashioned cookbooks to find these like long gone recipes that are 90% butter, 100% delicious.
Yeah.
The lost arts.
which do you have some favorites that you would share?
I like just like the Betty Crocker cookbook. I've got some old one. I don't even know what it's called because the cover is all like torn off, but it's just some random thing. I think it's like a church cookbook probably I got from some thrift store that has like old Southern recipes there.
Yeah.
I like that one. But a lot of the cookbooks, honestly, are just like kind of like too complicated, in my opinion. I don't really like things that have like too many ingredients or too many steps or just like expensive ingredients. Like, I'm not going to go out and get a bunch of like, you know, I don't want to pay $40 for ingredients or something that might be gross when I'm finished cooking it. You know, I'll just, I'd rather just go out for that much.
Yeah.
So I wanted to specifically try to keep mine kind of more, you know, just more common stuff and more simple and things you might already have, or if you don't have it, it's not going to be like that huge of an investment to get like one or two new ingredients to try.
And you can pick up at your local grocery or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I love some of those old cookbooks. I have, my mom, the cookbook that she always cooked out of, she had a copy of The Joy of Cooking and she had a copy of The Good Housekeeping Cookbook from like the 1940s. And so my sister got the copy that was actually my mom's, and I found a copy online, like I bought from eBay or something, of the same book. But side by side, my mom's copy was almost a half an inch thicker than the one I bought online, because it was like a library edition, so it was like wrapped in plastic and, you know, the whole thing.
Oh wow.
But mom's cover had broken, it was held together with duct tape, and it had so many recipes shoved in it and stuff stuck to pages from cooking that it was like a half inch thicker than it was originally. And I was like, to me, that's just like the mark of a good cookbook, right? That you've got dirty pages and your notes and stuff shoved in. And
that's what I hope people will make this book of mine dirty and write all in it and make notes in there and make it really personal for it'll be like a family heirloom, you know, your mom's copy of The Cookbook of Shadows.
Yeah, exactly. No, I love that. And I just, I mean, I have a little bit of a cookbook hoard. I divested in one of our many moves and I'm down to like one bookcase as opposed to the two bookcases of cookbooks I used to have. But yeah, like I'm just fascinated by like you said, like the church cookbooks and like these community cookbooks and like how people really cook at home. Mm-hmm. But I also really like shiny chef cookbooks too, I have to admit.
Right.
I don't know that I've cooked out of a lot of them, but I do love like the progression of, I guess, culinary arts too. Mm-hmm. So kind of both sides of that coin, like the simple home cooking, and I would never make this at home, but I would love for somebody else to make it for me and I would eat it.
Right.
So of the recipes in the book, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I think I would have to go with Happy Monkey Chocolate Banana Bread would be my favorite. Mm-hmm. It's a banana bread recipe with some chocolate chunks, and it's just designed to bring happiness and good cheer, and it's great for monkeying around.
Yeah, banana bread will never be a bad thing, in my opinion. It's funny, because when you were talking about the monkey bread and how your mom would call other things monkey bread, like, I had this very particular image of monkey bread in my brain. It's like that tear apart bread that's kind of like cinnamony and caramel, you know, like
yeah,
old, like dough balls, and you roll it and stuff. And so that was like my idea of monkey bread. And then I love this idea of it's kind of more about monkeying around with it. And
I think, you know, my mom honestly didn't know what monkey bread was, and she just called anything monkey bread once she realized, like, she could just call something monkey bread and I would eat it. And she could just like pawn anything off on me like it was dinner and be like, oh, some bread with gravy on it. Oh, that's monkey bread. That's dinner. And I'd be like stoked to eat it.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I mean, and I think there's, you know, like the, like you said, the stuff, the heirlooms, the stuff that gets passed down in your family. When I was in culinary school, we had, you know, like in my baking class, we had a bread day. And so all the students made different kinds of bread. And so everybody went home with like 20 different kinds of bread. And I was like, I don't know what to do with this. And my son had a friend over from school. And so I made French bread, French toast out of all of it. And it was like, you know, like a scroll roll and milk bread, you know, like all this kind of stuff. And he still like remembers that. And I mean, he's almost 30 now and he still talks about it. And he's like, do you remember that time when you made French toast and all the weird breads? So it's amazing what sticks, you know?
Yeah. Like,
they're kind of our own monkey bread experience. We just called it French.
Yes. Although, I definitely named that banana bread recipe in honor of my mom. I had to put monkey in the title there somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's sweet. And yeah, I mean, banana bread is, it's funny. I was thinking, like, I've read several magical cookbooks and I feel like banana bread is almost a universal. I don't know why, but I feel like almost every magical cookbook I've read has a banana bread recipe in it.
Another of my favorites that people could make to try out, because it doesn't have to be real exacting, I have in there is called courage sauce. So if you want to do something to raise your courage and strength and kind of feel, you know, get your defenses up, it's really good for like tacos or burritos. But basically you put like a couple tablespoons mayonnaise, a squirt of ketchup, and then put like a lot of garlic powder, a lot of chili powder, and a lot of paprika, and a lot of pepper, like as much as you'd like in there, and just keep tasting it and mixing it up. But it's such a good sauce for like tacos or burritos. And the spices are really like fortifying, where it'll make you feel like, yeah, you can do it.
If you can eat the spicy thing, you can do the hard thing.
Yeah.
I like that.
So it's like garlic, paprika if you want, chili powder is necessary, pepper if you want.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Do you think you would write another cookbook, or you think this is your one and done?
I would like to write another cookbook, because to be perfectly honest, my editor was like I cook like a poor person. Like I said, I'm from the South. I grew up poor in Arizona and then in the South, like, I cook like a poor person. So in writing this book, I specifically was like, well, I need to fancy up my recipes and make them, not all poor person style, because people like to cook fancier stuff. So I've specifically tried to make it fancier and elevated. So I turned in my manuscript and my editor is like, So Melanie, were you intending for this to be a budget cookbook? And I'm like, no, I tried specifically to make it not a budget cookbook, but mm-hmm. that's giving me the idea of I would like to do a budget cookbook because my budget level is like above and beyond or below under yeah. other people's idea of budget. So I think I could make like an extremely frugal budget cookbook of like how to not waste food and things like that. So I kind of would like to do that. I also yeah. would like to make like an all taco cookbook because I had too many taco recipes. I couldn't include in my book. So I'm like, this is going to be like 30% taco recipes. So I had to do some severe taco edits.
Yeah. Well, I imagine growing up in Arizona, some that tacos would be on the menu a lot. I mean, we're in California. And so we do tacos at least once a week. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, and it's easy and fun and you can play with it. I mean, we do occasionally some crazy fusion kind of tacos and stuff like that. Nice. So yeah. I've always joked, it's like, for me, I think there's a, you know, having gone to culinary school, I taught culinary school, I worked in hotels, I worked in restaurants, you know, I did all that. And there's something about this transition you make when you become a professional, like it's your job. Even if it's not like what people would consider like professional chef or whatever, but when you're cooking for a living and you're cooking for other people, you start to have this expectation, like this weird thing happens at home where you're like, you can't just make a meal. Like it has to have a sauce and it has to have, you know, you start to think in those terms. And so it's been interesting since I left the industry, which has been a while now. I think 2011 when I left teaching culinary school. And so I've really had to like relearn how to be a home cook in a weird way, which is, sounds really funny, I think. And then during the pandemic, I lost all will to cook. Like, I just didn't want to cook. I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want a meal plan. I didn't want to buy groceries. I just wanted food to magically appear in the kitchen. And now I'm kind of back to that, oh no, I enjoy this kind of thing. It's just interesting. Like, I think we all take these, I guess, adventures with the things that we do. Did you find like writing a cookbook kind of, was that weird? Like, did it impact like your daily cooking or like that experience of just cooking at home and kind of all that?
Well, I had to cook a lot to test all those recipes. So in that way, yes, but it was kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like an expression of my own like healing journey with food, because mm-hmm. in the past I've had problems with like kind of like disordered eating behaviors mm-hmm. in different ways, like depriving myself of food and also like some binge eating and things like that. Like, that's been a while now, but like part of my journey in getting better from that was learning to feel good about nourishing myself with mm-hmm. the food I was eating. And part of that was making it a magical process to prepare the food more mindfully and to eat that food more mindfully. So I don't really talk about that in my book at all. I don't think I might not even mention, I'm not sure, but
it's kind of like an underlying
of the book. Yeah, that kind of like, I wanted to give people kind of like a different, just a different perspective on food to kind of take, because lots of us can have very complicated relationships with food, mm-hmm. whether it's like overeating or undereating or just like having food insecurity or growing up with food insecurity mm-hmm. or, you know, having allergies that might, you know, might make food kind of, you know, scary or stress inducing sometimes. Like, there's lots of different things that can kind of mess up our relationships with food. So I feel like cooking more mindfully and magically and looking at the magical energies of our foods that we eat, like, it kind of helps us to like see it in a whole different perspective that can mm-hmm. kind of take that stress away. And then also helps you remember that like we are also connected to this earth and we're also part of this nature. So it can kind of help you feel like reconnected with the earth and feel good about, you know, you're part of the cycle of nourishment and you deserve to be nourished.
Mm-hmm. I think when you finish your budget cookbook, that's your next book.
Yes.
I mean, I do think that, especially in our culture in the US, and I'm going to speak to that mostly because I can't really speak to anything else, but we do have, and I think especially people who are, you know, raised as women, have this very complicated relationship with food because we're taught to have a complicated relationship with our bodies. Mm-hmm. And food is part of that. And that's such a good point about you know, like it isn't just calories. Like there's a whole lot of stuff that comes with that, like where the food, you know.
And the pandemic too, I think triggered a lot in a lot of people. Like, cause there was a lot of like scarcity, like you go to the store and there's like nothing there on the shelf. So like that really messed with me bad, honestly. Cause I had gotten to a point where I was like, I had felt like I was doing pretty good. And I was like over all the eating disorder. I was eating food every day and feeling like a champion about that. And then suddenly there's like not enough food, which instantly like plunges me into this mode of like, okay, I can only eat when I'm painfully hungry because I need to, you know, ration everything for everybody else. You know, yeah. I couldn't justify eating. And, you know, I think probably I'm not the only one that the pandemic brought up a lot of weird feelings about food in different ways, whether it was just like being depressed and eating copious amounts of food, or, you know, not eating because you're stressed out, or, you know, trying to suddenly feel like you've got to grow your own food and your food supply is in danger. Yeah. There's lots of stuff like that. So like writing this book was kind of coming out of all that. And, you know, just kind of an expression of like this healing journey with food that we can have, and this like better way to look at food where we can look at it magically and feel good about it and make, you know, even if it's humble ingredients, try to make those taste good. So,
yeah. I think that's important. And it was funny when you're saying about going into grocery stores during the pandemic and not being anything there. I remember seeing this picture, and as a Southerner, I will cop to being completely appalled. But I think it was like a Whole Foods in New York City. And, you know, they had the like the open bulk things of beans and nuts and rice and all that stuff. And everything was empty except the black eyed peas were full. They cleaned out the entire bulk area, but no one would eat the black eyed peas. And I was like, do people not know what to do with black eyed peas in New York? So I mean, weird. It was very weird. I was like, I'll take them, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Cause I do remember at the beginning of the pandemic, we had a little co-op where we lived in East Tennessee, and they also had bulk bins. And I went and I bought like a pound of every kind of bean, dried bean they had. That was like my pandemic panic buy was dried beans.
I feel so much better. Like if I have some dried beans and some rice and some flour in the house, I'm like, yeah. I can eat and not starve. It might not be tasty, but I can make something.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where we are too. And I mean, you know, well, and you know, West Coast life, you got fires, you got floods, you got earthquakes. So like, I always like to have something in the pantry.
Right.
Just in case, because you never know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to make a lot of the recipes in my book, like kind of like simple things too, so that people could kind of like have these foundations of things so they kind of can know how to like make more sauces and create soups and things like that. So I wanted to give people kind of those skills to create their stuff out of pantry ingredients.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that ability, like, to look at what you have and make a meal out of it without a recipe or without, you know, it is something you kind of learn at, you know, as a child cooking with your adult, right? It's that, like, that's just something you kind of get passed along without, there's never like an instruction about it, right? It's like my mom never sat me down and said, if you've got flour and butter and whatever, you can make biscuits and gravy. You know, she never said those things to me, but I watched it happen. As a kid, it's like, oh, I don't know what we're going to have for dinner. Open the pantry. And then 15 minutes later, we have, you know, dinners on the stove. And this is what we're having without cracking a cookbook or, you know. It's an interesting skill that I do think is maybe not getting passed along as much now. Like, I don't know. I feel like people are cooking more now than they were like even 10 years ago.
I feel like it's kind of a little bit of both. I feel like those who cook have gotten way fancier and way more elevated, where you have like 7-year-olds making just, you know, master chef quality things. But then I think in that, we have a lot of more like young people that are growing up now and feeling like, oh, well, I can't cook. I can't make these super fancy creations. So that's just not something I do. You know, I think there's like a kind of like more people that identify as like, I don't cook, because they're seeing cooking as like you know, you're supposed to be three and make this fondue or whatever.
Yeah. And it's like, sometimes it's okay to just bless the pizza rolls. I mean,
yeah. It doesn't have to be fancy to taste good. Like, common, simple ingredients can be delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think there is something, you know, growing up in the South, that, you know, you do kind of, like, the food is very simple. It's really good. And I mean, I think Southern food has been elevated in restaurants and things like that. But like, simple home cooked food is, you know, it's just kind of how people do it.
I think it honors the ingredients. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it honors the ingredients and that magical essence of the ingredient by keeping it simple. You're using that food's natural power, just kind of highlighting that and bringing it out. And you don't have to mask that. You can just let that be the star of the dish.
Yeah, one of my chefs in culinary school, when we were talking about like different styles of cooking, he was like, you know, French cuisine showcases the genius of the chef, and Italian cuisine showcases the genius of nature.
Oh, nice.
And that's always stuck with me about like what simple food really, like you said, it's elevating the ingredient itself. You're really showcasing that ingredient to make it the star, whether it's like, you know, a salad from a garden you picked, or stuff you got at the farmer's market, or stuff you got at your grocery store, you're honoring that thing. So, so yeah, I like that. Oh, I feel like I could talk cooking with you forever. So I'm excited about what's down the road for you writing wise. So before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I did want you to give you an opportunity to kind of tell people where they can find out more about your work or find you online or on social media. And like I said, this will come out toward the end of May. So if you have events or something this summer that you want to share with folks.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So the book is called Cookbook of Shadows. My name is Melanie Marquis. You can find me online at melaniemarquis.com. It's MelanieMarquis. MelanieMarquis.com, or you can find me on Facebook at Melanie Marquis Author. I also do a fun YouTube channel and TikTok channel called Stuffed Animal Magic Shop, magic with a K at the end, where my teddy bear for Blango does tarot readings and teaches magic from the magic shop and different fun things like that. We did a Thanksgiving parade we do every year. So you might check that out for some fun. But on my website, you can find my email address. I'm always open for people to reach out to, ask questions, or if you just want to talk about magic or tarot or cooking, I'm always open for that.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'll put all those links in the show notes too, so folks can get that easy. So since you are first-time guest, and I'll give you a little more rundown on how our game works at the end. So I always joke when I started the podcast, I'm a Scorpio. I don't know how to make small talk. I like to talk about the things we're not supposed to talk about. So this was a way to include that in the podcast.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick your own. And because we don't have a lot of rules, you can say pass. I don't want to answer a question about that. So.
All right. Let's go for it.
Let's see what we get. Or politics. Are you in?
I'm in.
Okay. So I was thinking about this because I do always try to make the questions about like your work or writing and not just like kind of, you know, out of left field. But so I was thinking about kind of what we were talking about with the ingredients and honoring those. So like thinking about food in a magical context and cooking with that. How do you navigate like sourcing food and like who's producing it and where it's coming from and what's used to grow it and its impact on the earth? Like, how do you navigate that as a cook? You know, while also trying to like, you know, not blow your budget on whatever. So how do you personally navigate that?
Yeah, it's kind of hard because some of the more quality ingredients do tend to be more expensive. I like to go to farmers markets when I can and get stuff from local growers. And I'm always shopping for the manager specials at the grocery store, getting the produce that's slightly beat up and good things like that. And you're also just trying to avoid things that are in a package, which is naturally going to make your eating healthier if you just try to, you know, be aware of the packaging of food and try to buy whole ingredients that you're making stuff with yourself. Like, you don't necessarily need soup in a metal can with a paper label when you can just make the soup yourself. Like, you know, so I try to make as much stuff by scratch as I can, and, you know, not buy a whole lot of packaged items when I shop.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I mean, that to me, that's something that we also try to do is really like, I mean, there's some stuff like, I could make crackers from scratch, but I don't always have time to do it. So like, there are things that we buy pre-made, but we make a lot of stuff from scratch for that reason. Like you said, it's often less expensive than buying manufactured stuff. And we got a lot less packaging and trash to deal with too.
Yeah. And just being aware too, I think, of the different ingredients and the environmental costs of different ingredients, you know, like meat production, you know, uses a lot of resources. You know, just kind of looking at things, almond production uses a lot of water, a lot of water, you know, just looking at things like that and being aware of the true cost of your food, I think just makes people more aware of like what maybe they don't want to buy a lot of or save for special occasions.
Yeah. And I think about that, like, you know, if you are thinking about things in terms of like the magic of the food you're producing, like, to me, like that energy, like you're right, especially around meat and stuff like that. We know like the industrial meat production is pretty unkind to animals. So like, if you're going to eat meat, how do you navigate that magically? You know, like, do you want to bring that energy of like the CAFO into your magic and your body? Like, I think it's complicated. It's a complicated.
Yeah. It needs to be acknowledged. I feel like, you know, like I'll eat meat. I used to not eat meat like ever. I was a vegetarian for years and years and years. But then in trying to recover from my disordered eating behaviors, I've started eating some chicken because honestly, I needed to get my protein up. I was in very bad health from deteriorating my body to the extent that I had. And so now I will occasionally eat chicken now. But I think it's just important to realize, like, you know, if you're eating another animal, realize you're eating another animal, you know, and that is the way of nature, but like, you know, be aware of that because that is a sacred thing you're doing. It's an exchange of energy, you know? So I think absolutely take that into account in the magic, you know, and let it add to the power of the act.
Yeah. Oh, Melanie, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your work and your thoughts and, you know, vulnerability too. Like, I think we covered a lot of ground, and I'm really glad to have you on and have talked about this stuff. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And let's talk again when you get that next cookbook out.
Yeah, appreciate having me on today. Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.